C7. Number 12A.
We come to the chapter Physiology. Well, here we have an interesting chapter in so far that we feel, well, physiology has to do with the construction, the structure of our body. And therefore, as we seem to have a body of our own, there is naturally the belief that we are a god. We are our own king and we are our own being. We have a being of our own, which would naturally be the very opposite of what we learn in science. But this concept is just a false interpretation of what has gone on before. If before, the sixth chapter has shown that Immanuel, God with me, if God is with me, then I am a God. If I have no other nature than the nature that God has, then the logic could be, then I'm a God. And in a way, it's quite interesting to see that naturally in the Old Testament they would have refuted such a statement. There is only one God, and that God would somehow live on Mount Horeb where nobody could trace him. And whereas if one reads the New Testament, Jesus would somehow accept, yes, I'm God. There are here and there statements, especially in John, where he said, yes, when the accusation came, well, you are a God. He said, so what? Why not? It all depends what we understand under the term. We can misunderstand it or understand it. This seems to be the deeper question that the chapter on physiology is dealing with, because it starts out with that argument where in the introductory paragraph she says, physiology is one of the apples from the tree of knowledge. Evil declared that eating this fruit would open man's eyes and make him as a god. Instead of so doing, it closed the eyes of mortals to man's God-given dominion over the earth. So the question is, what kind of a tree was there in paradise? The tree of knowledge of good and evil. Because according to the symbolism of the Old Testament, that tree stood at the same place as the tree of life. So for one it was the tree of life, and for the other one it was the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Again, we must see that apparently it is only the standpoint that defines what something is. That if we lose the right standpoint, that we lose therefore the right interpretation. So the sixth chapter with the God with us somehow would indicate that we are God, that we have the same nature as God, but indicating that that is only true from the standpoint of God, because from the standpoint of God there is only one God. Yeah? From the standpoint of God, God cannot say, I'm God and everything else is no gods. Therefore, from the standpoint of the tree of life, there is God, and there is God, and that's God, and that's all. Therefore, everything is God. And it's only when we take the standpoint outside, another standpoint that does not go out from that God, that that other standpoint therefore makes out of something that good is fundamentally right a proposition of being either right or being wrong. And this is the question in physiology. And physiology therefore explains how if we go out from another standpoint than God, if we go out from mortal mind, then through the first part of the chapter on physiology, it shows that if we build on a standpoint outside of God, we build up really an idol, namely a physiological concept of being, a physiological concept of God, which is called a mortal who behaves like a God. And so the great question is, are there two standpoints from which we can look at the same thing? Is it legitimate to look at the same thing from two standpoints? Is it legitimate to have a coin and look at it from two faces? And when we are at the point of oneness, we are not allowed to do that. From the point of view of oneness, we have just one standpoint, and from that one standpoint, everything must be interpreted. Therefore, the chapter on physiology would always wake us up and say, be aware that you are working out from the right standpoint, that you are working out from the standpoint of the sixth chapter. If you don't work out from the standpoint of the sixth chapter, you are not working out from the right standpoint, and all what you get is hell. And you build up just as much hell as you like. It's up into your hands to decide from which standpoint are you going to look at oneness. If you look at the point of oneness from the infinite one, you have the sixth chapter. If you try to look at that oneness from a standpoint outside, you have physiology. You have the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you have duality in its best sense, and all what you do is to build up a lot of little gods, or of little devils, or of big devils, whatever we like better. When you read this chapter, you constantly hear that calling. Don't work from two standpoints, and don't work from a standpoint outside of God. She says, we cannot obey both physiology and spirit. Can you see the two standpoints? It is impossible to work from two standpoints, she says. She says, it is not wise to take a halting or halfway position. You have to take one standpoint. It is not wise to work equally, can you see again, with spirit and matter, truth and error. Constantly, she says, what is your standpoint? Which one is your standpoint? Is it spirit or matter? Is it that you rely, the same thing as what is your standpoint, is it that you rely on? And then she gives a whole list of a false standpoint and of going out from a false basis. Are you relying on brain and muscles, on material knowledge, on non-intelligent matter, on physical laws, on man-made material theories, on drugs, on physiology and hygiene, trust in air, exercise, rules of health, material means, material modes, material codes, and so on? Can you hear? It's that chapter which asks us to say, you can only work out from one standpoint, and that must be the standpoint of the sixth chapter. So, in the seventh, it's just the consequence, taking the consequences of the sixth chapter. It's that tree of knowledge of good and evil. It is really that tree of knowledge which we believe in so much, namely, that there are two realms, two universes, that we agree that the spiritual universe is governed spiritually, and there we agree that the material universe is governed by material laws. And we live with that duality. Practically, day in and day out, we live with that. That we have a spiritual universe, and we live with spirit. There we agree that there are spiritual laws ruling. And at the same time, we live in the material universe, and we certainly obey the material laws. In most cases, now I think it's a good thing that we obey the material laws in most cases, or I don't know how we would drive a motor car up the roads and on the highway. We better obey the material laws, and we better take the elevator than to walk out of the window when we are on the 26th story. You see, we really are faced with a very dualistic universe. Fundamentally, we believe, and that's the tree of knowledge, we still believe, and in a way, because we have not seen much deeper into the whole thing, we better obey even those two universes, that we say there is a universe, that a material universe that must be governed by material principle, and the spiritual universe that is, must be governed by spiritual principle. Actually, this is a duality that somewhere, somehow, has to be overcome. And we know that she says, come gently out of matter into spirit, so don't jump out of your window if you want to go down to the street. There is still something to be obeyed. But then we ask ourselves, well, that's the universe of our beliefs. We live in that universe of beliefs, but there must be an answer to it. And Jesus did give an answer. And finally, we must find that answer. Jesus did give the answer that the material laws, whatever they are of no effect, have no power, that they have no nothing in themselves, and they have only that what we attribute to them. So he could walk over the waves and walk through the doors, and he could overcome distance in a second and so on, but that was at the end of his career. He didn't do that right away when he was a young boy. When he went up to Jerusalem, he still took his little ass and rode on it. Later, when he went down to Jericho, he didn't take any more little ass, he just went down. Well, here we have it. And therefore, it's interesting to see that this chapter somehow has two parts, in which she shows in the first part that there apparently is a material universe governed according to material laws, but also shows that these material laws finally lead to destruction, that they have no fulfillment in themselves, and then shows in the second part how we can awake out of the physiological sense of life into a spiritual sense of life, but that whole second part is showing the awakening sense of it and does not give the ultimate spiritual realm of the spiritual universe. That comes afterwards in the 9th and 10th chapter, but here, at the point of the 7th chapter, she gives a way out. And the way out that she presents is naturally through the sense that there is but one God, and that for God all things are possible. So, her teaching here is a basic teaching that there are not two realms, that there is not a material universe that has actual material laws and a spiritual universe that has actual spiritual laws, but that finally we will have to see, and we better start now there where we can start, namely with our body, where we can have dominion rather soon, with little effort, because it's easier to control organic matter than it is to control inorganic matter. To control a stone is much more difficult than to control our heartbeats. The belief that that organic matter is not so material, not so opaque, not so stubborn as the belief of inorganic matter. We can easily lift up our arm, but it's with mental means, through thinking, but it's not so easy to lift up a stone with mental means. Though they do it. In India, they do it. That's no trouble for some of these Indian wise men. They just shout and shout to their ghost or to their dead guru or whatever it is and shout until a heavy stone that nobody could move just lifts itself up. So they can do it. The phenomena of levitation becomes much more possible, and we not even need an Uri Geller to do that, but everyone knows it's much easier to control and rule organic matter through spiritual means than it is to control inorganic matter. So the great point here is that there is only one principle that is ruling in both fields, the field of truth and the field of belief. That truth is omnipotent in the realm of belief as well as in the realm of truth. I think if we have this, I think we cover, so to say, both parts of the chapter on physiology. The first part shows how God is able to have dominion over the physical universe, and the second part shows how truth has dominion in the spiritual universe and therefore is able to develop the spiritual within man. Just to pinpoint the oneness in this chapter, there are a lot of statements that bring out that there is but one God. You see, not the dualistic sense of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. It is a cry to have one God, she says. There is but one way, namely God and his ideas. She says, not to depart from the basis of the one God, the one lawmaker. See, only one lawmaker that makes the law for the spiritual realm and for the material realm. That we should give to the one mind only honor, that the one mind only is entitled to honor, so as to bring it really home that the universe, the realm, is governed, that every realm is governed by one central God or principle. Now, can you listen and hear that this is now the Christ as Christianity? The Christ, that which says there is one God that expresses, that manifests his power, that's the Christ. Where? The moment you ask where, you ask for the realm. And you know that the realm is always the point of Christianity. The realm of creation, the realm of man, the realm of the universe, this is always at the point of Christianity, the outcome of the Christ idea. So, here we have the position, the place value of Christ in Christianity, now showing that in Christianity, in any realm, there is only one power at work. That in the realm of truth is the power of truth at work. That in the realm of belief, the power of truth is also at work. That no other power can be at work in another realm. So you have a power sense in every realm. How does she bring up this whole thing? Let's go to the scriptural note, the first one she has there, which helps us quite a bit. She says, "Therefore I say unto you, take no thought for your life." Take no thought, take no thought, take no thought. See, don't go out from your point of view. Don't go out from a standpoint outside of the one mind. Take no thought. Don't think that things are the way you look at it. Don't think you can rule a realm with your thought, with your approach, from your standpoint. Remember I said all through the chapter goes the cry, have only one standpoint, only one God, don't mix it up, don't have two masters, don't serve two masters, give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, but give to God what belongs to God. So take no thought for your life, what you shall eat or what you shall drink, nor yet for your body, what you shall put on. Is not the life more than meat, and the body than raiment? Can you see? Don't try to feel that the realm in which you live, the realm of your body, the realm of your circumstances, the realm of your surrounding, is something that you can dominate, that you can control with your thought, from your standpoint. From your standpoint. Therefore, always the first thing is put the problem behind you. That's how Mr. Dawley always would start when he was explaining the method of treatment, that he said, take the problem, put it behind you in a corner, and then turn away, turn yourself 180 degrees and look into the immensity of mind. See, take no thought. Don't consider the universe, don't consider the problem, don't consider your body, don't consider the symptoms, don't consider anything. Go out from mind. Mrs. Eddy says in here, your remedy lies in forgetting the whole thing. She says, don't investigate the problem, not to be concerned about the problem, not to let yourself be mesmerized by the problem, not to argue mentally with the problem. You know, that is, humanly seen, one of the most difficult part in the treatment, or when somebody is right down in a crisis, in a mess, that it is very hard to get one's thought away from the case, from what the case argues, and you constantly begin to argue, yes, but if this is so, then it will be so, and if it would happen so and so, it could happen so and so. You argue on a level of mortal mind and of human thought, and it's quite mesmeric how these buts and whys and ifs and whens come in, and they constantly come in. Well, we have seen in the obstetrics, really, we can only give birth to an idea if we detach mortal thought from all its material conception. That's really what she's asking here in physiology. Forget it. Don't shut your eyes to it, but forget it. Don't say it's no problem. But don't argue with it. Don't consider it. You have to do something naturally about it. It is not enough just to sweep it under the carpet and say, now I don't see it anymore, so it's gone. It isn't gone because of that. It's only gone when we then fill our thought from the standpoint of God. It's all in here where she brings out that she says, you know, the problem and your thinking is always the same thing, that mortal mind and disease is one. You have a sense of oneness here that is brought out in the negative as practically no other chapter. Here she says, mortal mind and body is one. The mental and the physical oneness is a marginal heading. The belief and the result of the belief are inseparable. You see, here you have a oneness of standpoint and the universe in which we live. It's a oneness that we say, the kind of consciousness we entertain, the kind of experience we have. that we cannot experience anything which we haven't experienced first in our consciousness. So this is in a negative realm, and then naturally she puts it up to the positive realm and says, all right, the consciousness you have from the standpoint, that kind of an experience we have in the human. So again here, it's a terrific sense of asking us to get away from that false sense of oneness, that false sense of the distorted sense of oneness, mortal mind and disease being one, and say, turn away from matter, and turn away from belief, and turn to God. Right through there is that sense of always turning away from matter to spirit. And then, she says, you hear, in the measure as you do it, or this is a measuring your position in Christian Science. She says, the very fact of how much we can turn away from the problem and turn towards the one God, she says, this shows your position as a Christian Scientist. But can you see here, your position as a Christian Scientist is something completely different than what we, for instance, will find very distinctly in the 13th chapter. There, your position as a Christian Scientist is depicted completely different. Huh? But here, in physiology, it is first seeing that we detach ourselves from a false sense of oneness in order to really get a true sense of oneness. Namely, what sense of oneness? And then she gives the terrific sense of oneness that that really mind is... How did Joshi put it? That the mind is the cause and condition of all existence. Huh? That mind is not only the cause, but also the condition of all existence. Can you hear that Christ is Christianity? That she says, this Christ is that which causes everything. What does it cause? The whole realm, the condition of everything. And so mind is not only the cause, but also the condition of all existence. Mind is not only in the world, somewhere up there, and then somehow some little drops drop down somewhere to the universe, and somewhere in the universe something happens with these little drops. But he said, no, the whole of mind comes right down and is the condition of the universe itself. And in this chapter alone we have these terrific statements. Yes. All right.